anger over events in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City have poured into streets across the country and across social media. It has also led to some face-to-face conversations and deep soul-searching on racial matters. UW La Crosse recently held an open forum to talk about racial issues. As Maureen McCollum reports, they're exploring how to make the community a more inclusive and safe place for people of all backgrounds.
AJ Jackson thinks about race every day. The UW La Crosse sophomore says she doesn't always feel comfortable on a campus that, as of last fall, is 89% white. Conversations about race and Ferguson and grand juries have not been taking place in Jackson's classrooms. She needed a place to speak her mind and hear what her peers were thinking.
I am a black woman, so these issues really do hit home for me in the community and just things that I think about every day, things that really touch my heart.
That's why Jackson came to the UWL Open Forum, Healing After Ferguson. As part of the program, a wide variety of voices stepped up to the microphone, some people defending police officers and others calling out inequalities on campus. In UWL's 2013 Campus Climate Survey, students and employees of color reported being more likely to experience discrimination and be bullied or intimidated by peers. Jackson says it's time to have tough, honest, and regular conversations about race on UWL's campus. She says it's not going to be comfortable.
We all have to listen to our own point of views, and we all have to come together as a society and realize that we're never all going to see eye to eye on the topic of racism, but it is important to address it, and it is important to remain calm and to remain open-minded and understanding in these uncomfortable situations.
There's a push to have similar events more frequently on campus. UWL officials also hope more people submit hate incident reports when they experience or witness discrimination so the issue can be handled. Another step is moving the conversation beyond the campus borders and into the greater La Crosse community. UWL graduate student Shondell Spivey helped organize a protest in La Crosse after a grand jury decided not to indict a white Ferguson police officer in the death of an African-American teenager.
Ferguson, you know, is the gasoline to ignite the fire that has been happening systematically with racism and oppression.
Spivey has been working with the La Crosse Police Department, trying to develop a relationship among officers, UWL students, and communities of color.
La Crosse is growing, right? Like, whether we want it to or not, La Crosse is growing. And there's a lot of black families here that were affected by that decision. And we want to make sure that our police department is not operating in a biased way towards people of color.
Police Captain Robert Lawrence says he wants to build on those relationships too, especially with people who have negative perceptions of police. He says he became an officer to serve the community, not divide it. Earlier this semester, Lawrence sat on a panel about knowing your rights. Next semester, he'll teach a seminar aimed at educating the public about police use of force.
Unless we start having these conversations and try to breach this void where people hate me because of this uniform I wear, we have to start talking, we have to start understanding, we have to start getting real about, you know, what this is all about.
Lawrence says that's not going to be easy.
This ranks up there with, you know, solving world peace, and, you know, because that's really what it is about peace. It's about understanding, it's about, you know, it's about hatred, and I think there's a lot of things to work on.
And Lawrence says he's proud to be part of that conversation. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
The United States is in the midst of its most profound demographic transformation since the baby boom after World War II. In 2020, the census is expected to show that minorities make up 40% of the country's population.
Demographer William Fry is with us to talk about the shift to a nation with no racial majority and how this will impact life in the United States. He's a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and research professor in population studies at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you today.
Well, demographics are always in flux. What makes these current demographic trends so remarkable to you?
You know, I look at numbers all the time. I'm kind of a census geek, and I've been doing it for quite a while. And when I looked at the results of the 2010 census, We've looked at some of the projections. We've looked at what's happened in the last couple of presidential elections. It's pretty clear to me that this is a pivotal period in the United States for racial demographic change and racial change in general. I point out that a big demographic phenomenon that people are very understanding of is the baby boom in the last part of the 20th century. It affected everything. It affected lifestyles, family changes, women's roles, everything. But I think the new diversity boom that we're having in this century, in 2050, people are going to look back at this period right now and say this is a transformational period in the United States, and it's the new young, growing, diverse minority populations that are going to be leading the way toward our growth, toward our productivity, if we do things correctly, if we plan appropriately for it. But people are going to recognize this if they haven't already in big ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's break it down just a little bit. First of all, paint a picture for us. What will the country look like in the next 50 years?
Oh, well, in about 50 years, we're going to be what's called a majority-minority. it's hard for me to say because we use the kind of racial categories we use now, whites, Asians, blacks, Hispanics. The multiracial population, as a result of probably several generations of people marrying folks of other racial and ethnic backgrounds, will make those categories completely obsolete. So even the idea that we're less than 50% white, which is if you do kind of a mechanical projection ahead, would show that. But I think it's going to be we're going to be much more blended than that. And there'll be a big Hispanic influence. There'll be a big Asian influence and still substantial numbers of people with at least grandparents and great-grandparents who call themselves just black or just white, but it'll be a very blended society.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that will manifest itself among society? Well, first of all, let's just talk about breaking the country up a little bit. What trends will we see in certain parts of the country?
You know, I think that, you know, part of this transformational period that we're seeing now involves population shifts across different parts of the country. If we look back to, say, the early 1990s and you thought about where do most of the Hispanics live and most of the Asians live, you would pick out a few metropolitan areas like Los Angeles and New York or Miami for Hispanics and San Francisco and Seattle for Asians. Not all of those groups live there, but a very high percentage of them. And a lot of the interior part of the country, to the extent there was a minority population, was primarily African-American population. Well, all of that has started to shift inward, especially into growing parts of the country in the Southeast and in the Mountain West. I've calculated there are 145 metropolitan areas that I call new Hispanic destinations. These are places that have grown very rapidly in their Hispanic population. Still not a big population there, but it's that rate of growth which is making them part of a dynamic population in those areas. The other thing that has continued to go along, and people have not really recognized it, I think, as much as they might have, is a continuing black migration to the South. It started in small numbers in the 1970s. Of course, a lot of people who read American history know that blacks had left the South in big numbers in the 20th century. But starting in around the 1970s, blacks started to move to the South a little bit, and I would call that more being pushed out of the North. There was a lot of deindustrialization. Race relations were not very good. A lot of race riots. We talk about the riots now or the difficulties now, but compared to then, those were really kind of difficult and brought a lot of blacks back to the South. But in the last two decades, I would say it was more of a pull rather than a push. The South has become economically prosperous, and considerable black populations, professional middle-class black populations, have emerged in states like Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, and Florida. And young people who are African Americans are more likely go to the South when they moved and to any other region. And as a result, the South has continued to become and continue to be a black-white region as it becomes more prosperous and as more African Americans move there and are prosperous. So these are some changes that we've seen and will probably continue to see.
And yet, you also point out while there is this trend toward a more prosperous black population down in the South, there are still statistics across the country about racial disparities, poverty in the education system, the criminal justice system. Can you help explain why there seems to be these two competing or contrasting types of statistics?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to sound like we have or even close to solving the issues with racial disparities in the United States. Back in the 1960s, we had the civil rights laws and the civil rights movement, and I think people thought when we got to 2010 or 2014 or 2020, a lot of things would have been wiped away, and they're not. There are huge disparities between blacks and whites, between Asians, between Hispanics and whites, with respect to Asians who are doing, by and large, a little bit better, still have to deal with confronting obstacles to getting promotions and advancements and so forth. So I don't mean to say that those problems are gone. What the book does say is that the demography is so powerful in the United States that as we move ahead to 2020 and 2030, there's actually going to be a decline in the white population and an aging of the white population. So most of our youth population, most of our younger labor force population will be racial minorities. And when we have that situation, these folks are going to have much more clout, not only in the ballot box, but also take positions of responsibility. You know, back in the 1960s, when we did have that civil rights initiative in the United States, only about 15% of the population were racial minorities. In the 2020 census, as you noted at the beginning, more than 40% of the population will be racial minorities, and more than half of the people under age 30 will be racial minorities. So it's a slow-moving pattern. We're still going to have to deal with these issues, but I think it's going to be much more in everyone's interest to deal with these disparities when we have a minority population that's becoming more mainstream and more numerous in our country.
We're talking with demographer Bill Fry about his book, The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. And we'll look at how those demographics will affect things like politics in our own neighborhoods.
And we want to hear from you. How do you think this increased diversity will change America? Do you think this is good for the country? And where do you see it taking us as a country and a society? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with demographer Bill Fry about his new book, The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America.
And we're taking your calls, too. How do you see changing demographics changing American politics? Do you think it's a good thing for our country to have soon-to-be no racial majority in particular? How do you think politicians will respond to this increased diversity? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. William, what generational gaps will come about as a result of some of these changing demographics?
You know, I think this is one of the challenges that we have in the United States as we have this generational gap going on. I made the analogy to the baby boom earlier that we now have a diversity boom, not a baby boom. Back when the baby boom was young, we had something called a generational gap between kind of the older population, which is more establishment, and these younger hippies and Woodstock generation folks that had all kinds of ideas of what they needed to do. Well, we're now facing another generational gap. It's probably even more serious, and that's something I call a cultural generation gap. Most of the young people today, very soon, in about 4 or 5 years, more than half the people under 18 in the United States will be racial and ethnic minorities. Hispanics, Asians, African Americans, multiracial, and other minority groups. Whereas if you look at the older part of the population, especially people over age 50, more than 70% of them will be Anglos, and the biggest racial minority population will be African Americans. So they have somewhat different ways of looking at the world. And some of the surveys that have been taken show that these older folks are a little bit resistant to embracing the change, especially the change toward diversity, especially new immigration to the United States. And as a result, you know, they're not as open to just not only the acceptance of these younger folks, but also when it comes to politics and how they vote. They tend to vote for issues that don't provide for a safety net, for better education, for the kinds of things younger people and young adults want, as opposed to things that they're more interested in, such as medical care and Social Security. And that kind of generational gap translates into politics. I think we've seen some of that in some of the presidential elections. The Republican candidates in the last two presidential elections got a lot of their votes from the older and whiter parts of the population. Barack Obama got a lot of his votes from the younger and more minority parts of the population, not just because he was an African American, but because of the kinds of policies that he and the Democratic Party represented with respect to the younger population. So I think that eventually, given this huge demographic force that's coming along, both parties are going to understand that they're going to have to think about the needs of the younger part of the population, as well as baby boomers, who will soon come to realize that if they want to have those Social Security checks coming in, it's going to have to be generated by the productivity of these younger minorities as they make their way through the labor force.
What I'm hearing you say without actually saying it is that there's a lot of adjustment that we all need to be prepared for, both on a systemic level but also individually. How do you recommend going about that, to be prepared for the actual tangible changes that we're going to experience in our lifetime?
You know, I think it takes some very important leadership. I think people need to be made to understand why this younger population deserves to have investment in their future, because it means that the country is going to prosper. You know, I'm vain enough to think that people should read my book to understand this, because, you know, I do play out all the demographic forces that are going to be coming into play. But, you know, I think corporate leadership, political leadership, local communities, churches, and so forth, these are the kinds of folks need to speak out. I mean, oftentimes we hear some politicians try to play on these fears that older people might have toward sort of new minorities coming into their community. And, I think it should be the reverse. And I hope it will be the reverse. I think we have a history in this country of reaching out to people from other parts of the world. We are a melting pot country by our historical standards. And I do think there's enough of that in our DNA that eventually people are going to come to realize that.
So as we move into a future where there is no particular racial majority, do you foresee a society that is more understanding of one another, or one that is more divided?
You know, I'm optimistic about being more understanding of one each other. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic about this is because it's the younger part of the population that appears to be more open to accepting people from different backgrounds. This is the part of the population that is already seeing interracial dating, interracial marriage, much more open ideas about immigration and about what the government should do to help folks get a leg up in our society. So I think as those younger people keep, aging and they have kids, the attitudes will change, and it will even change among the older population, I think, as they see the direction our country is moving toward.
Some people get anxious when they hear about the phrase, or when they hear the phrase minority white. But why might it be a good thing, something that one should embrace as they hear about this boom in minority populations?
You know, one of the reasons why this is important is we're becoming a globalized world, a globalized economy, I should say. And as we get more connected to other parts of the world, not only in our economy, but in our, social media relationships, it's very important to have that understanding of different people across the globe. And that's what we get from these younger people. That's what we get from new minorities, first, second, and soon third generation folks from Latin America and Asia and other parts of the world that are going to be a dominant part of our population, a dominant part of our workforce, a dominant part of our classrooms at the high school level and in the college level, and dispersing out to different parts of the country. So, you know, I'm just optimistic those divisions are going to fade. The old days when we had sort of just whites and then another minority kind of separated in very high levels of residential segregation, not that much interracial marriage, I think that's all going to turn around.
And in our last minute here, what's your takeaway for us as neighbors, as individuals who start to see this demographic shift taking hold in our lives?
You know, I think we need to take kind of the broader view. A lot of the places where the challenges are greatest are where the new minority growth is something that just occurred. We don't see as much of these challenges right now in places like California or Texas or New York City, much of New York City anyway, where there's been many, many decades of minorities moving in and being part of the mainstream. A lot of it is in these kind of new areas like a suburb like Ferguson. where the institutions have not yet come along to sort of deal with these changes. I think individuals should kind of look around what's going on in the rest of the country and try to do what they can on an individual basis to make things better for their neighbors.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
That was William Fry, Senior Fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and Research Professor in Population Studies at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of The Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America.